MacCast, Monday, January 28th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it is Macworld iWorld week. I'm getting ready in just a couple days here to head up to San Francisco for that event. If you're planning on coming out and joining us, I would love to see you. I'm going to be out on the show floor each and every day, kind of ferreting out all the cool products and stuff that are being shown off at Macworld. And if you see me hanging around, please stop by, say hi. I'd love to shake your hand and thank you for being a listener to the MacCast. Also, I'll be on Twitter and sending out my location and where I'm at. So if you want to follow and see what I'm up to, I'll try and post pictures. I try every year to post some pictures, but inevitably fall behind on that. So I'm not going to commit to anything with that in that regard, but I'll do my best to kind of give you the best coverage I possibly can. I'm really there to get the interviews so that I can put out a couple shows for you on exactly what was going on at Macworld. And I am going to be doing that live show. So if you happen to be around on Friday from 2:30 to 3:30, it's going to be somewhere on the expo floor. I'm not exactly sure where. Check your programs and please come on by. I've got a couple of you lined up to do some interviews. We're going to be talking about what's going on at Macworld, why you come out to Macworld, and what you're particularly enjoying about the show. So it should be a lot of fun. I'm looking very much forward to it. But we got a lot of stuff to get into in this episode. Apple had its first quarter earnings call, so we got all the details from that. Again, more rumors on upcoming Apple and Mac products, and great questions and feedback from you. So I want to get into that in just a moment, but I have a couple of sponsors to thank here up the front. The first being ShareFile by Citrix. You know, how many of us have had this happen? You are working on an important project, you need to email a file or a document to someone, and you go to send it, and it's just too big to get sent by email. Or it's a particularly sensitive document you need to share, so you need to know it's secure, and you can't rely on some service that just sort of obfuscates the URL. It has to be more robust than that. Or maybe you've gone on a business trip and you forgot that one critical file for the presentation that you're working on. It's back at the office, you know it's there, but you don't have easy access to it. These are all problems that ShareFile by Citrix can provide a solution for. It was designed specifically for business use, and it lets you send files of almost any size and provides access to those files from any computer or mobile device. And what I really like about ShareFile is its business focus. It is designed to integrate into your business and give you a really professional experience for your clients, your customers. It has branding, it has widgets, so you can build this experience that has your logo and your colors. You can match your identity so that when your customers are getting in there to access files or you're sending files, they're seeing your brand. The widgets allow you to add functionality like login and file uploads directly on your site, so they're not getting sent off someplace else. And it lets you share and receive files just by sending emails. Your customers get a link to download or upload files, and it's secure. Those pages are secure. You can also set limits. So if you only want someone to have access to a file a certain number of times, you can do per downloads. You can set the length of time that those files are available, and you don't have to worry about having to go pull them back down. And it's just really convenient. You have to try ShareFile today. You can get started with a risk-free offer. Full 30-day free trial. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. Remember, visit sharefile.com and type in my offer code MACCAST and try it out today. Big thank you to Citrix and ShareFile for their support of the MACCAST. I also want to thank Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, one of my favorite features of Notebook is the clipping service, and I love it because it's great for quickly organizing your research as you're working on a project. What I like to do is set up a notebook. You can put sections into it for the different areas and different topics that you might be working on. And then I add a clipping service to each one of those sections. So for example, say I'm working on Apple News. I might have a section for the iOS update that is just come out, a section on the earnings call, and maybe another section for rumored product updates that are happening. And I put a clipping service on each one of those. And then what's great about that is I can go into Safari or into my RSS reader, and when I see something that I want to cover, all I have to do is select it and then use the built-in OS X services, the service menu. I can clip it right into the specific section of my notebook. It copies all of the text and puts it right there, and I never have to leave the app that I'm in or working on. So I don't have to do the whole cut and paste back and forth thing. I can stay right inside my app, know that that's shuffled off, it's in my notes now, and I can come back and review it. And because it's a service, it works system-wide, so I can even do it from applications like Mail. And the bonus is that when I go back and I'm working in my notebook, they have snapback links, so I can automatically jump back from my notebook back to the source if I need to re-reference the article, if I want to go back and review something, if I want to get more info. And that is just one of the awesome features that is in Notebook. It does all kinds of other stuff. I've told you about all the great things in the past, and you can try it free for 30 days. So if you just go to circusponies.com, you can download it, you can give it a try, and it's just a great application. I know you're going to love it. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the MacCast. Apple had its first quarter 2013 earnings report call on Wednesday, and they once again broke records. Apple reported record quarterly revenue of $54.5 billion and recorded net quarterly profits of $13.1 billion. That was even while they saw a slight dip in their gross margins. Gross margin was 38.6%. That was down from 44.7% a year ago, but still very healthy. And interesting, a large portion of that revenue came from international sales. Apple announced that international sales accounted for 61% of revenue. As far as the product breakdown goes, iPhone sales were up to a record 47.8 million compared to about 37 million just a year ago. Apple sold 22.9 million iPads. That was up significantly from last year, where Apple sold 15.4 million units. A little bit of bad news, though, on the Mac side. Mac sales were down slightly. Apple sold 4.1 million Macs in the quarter. That's versus 5.2 million in the same quarter a year ago. And iPod sales, not surprisingly, continued to decline. Apple sold 12.7 million iPods this quarter. That's versus 15.4 million in the year ago quarter. And even though iPod sales are declining, the iPod Touch does continue to be the most popular of all the iPod models. Apple noted that 50% of all iPods sold were iPod Touches. And then once again this quarter, the Apple TV continues to be the surprising product. Apple announced that Apple TV sales were up 60% year over year, with Apple selling 2 million units in the quarter. I'd say that's not bad for something that Apple simply calls a hobby. So overall, very, very positive results for Apple once again this quarter. And as a matter of fact, they continue to have a pretty nice cash war chest. Apple now has $137.1 billion cash on hand. I don't think quite as much as they had or have had in the past, but still nothing to sneeze at. And despite all the positive revenue news for this quarter, Apple's stock took a beating following the call. I think almost immediately dropping 10% in after hours trading, and then the next day dipping down even more. It's been a little bit of a roller coaster ride, I think, all week. And a lot of people were speculating that just investors weren't happy with the change in the numbers. They didn't move enough in the positive direction, even though, again, they reported record quarterly revenue and record net profit. So there was some confusion about why Investors were so spooked over these numbers. There's a little uncertainty about the supply chain and what have you, but nothing seemed to add up to the kind of drops we saw in the stock price following the call. And then a couple of people started looking at some of the things that were said, and it came out that maybe the reason investors were a little bit spooked is Apple decided to change how they're doing their guidance moving into the next quarter. In the past, Apple has always given guidance with a pretty specific number, and that number tended to be lower than Apple would normally hit. So most investors came to rely on the fact that they could take Apple's guidance and shoot above that, and that was where Apple was likely to going to come in at. And during this call, they announced that they were going to be changing their guidance going forward, doing more of a range of guidance, and it seems likely that that's something that investors are a little bit concerned about, that they're not going to be able to more accurately predict sort of where Apple's going to land because maybe Apple is a little bit less unsure. I don't know if that's, you know, actually the case or if that's what's going on, but that's sort of what I was reading in the analysis following the call. And I don't know if you've ever listened in on one of these calls. You can actually go to Apple's website and listen in live as they're having the report. And so it starts off with Tim Cook and Peter Oppenheimer and the executives going over the numbers. But then after the call, I think the most interesting stuff happens because they do this little Q&A session. So a couple of highlights from the Q&A. Peter Oppenheimer said that without the iMac supply constraints, that Apple's Mac sales would have likely had been higher. And Tim Cook sort of also backed him up on that. He also said that iPad sales were impacting Mac sales. So there is some cannibalization going on, but they sort of played it off saying that they really knew and kind of expected that to happen. I think it's no secret that Tim Cook in the past has said that they fully expect tablet sales and iPad sales to exceed PC sales moving forward. So I think they've accounted for that and sort of built it into how they're going to run the business moving forward. And so those are some of the numbers and the highlights from the first quarter results call. I wanted to mention one other thing that was particularly interesting, and it actually happened right before Apple's earnings call. Both Verizon and AT&T announced their fourth quarter 2012 earnings numbers, and both of them noted significant percentages of iPhone sales when it came to their overall smartphone sales. Verizon sold 9.8 million smartphones in the quarter, and 6.2 million of those were iPhones. That's 63%. On the AT&T side, they said they sold 10.2 million smartphones, and that 8.6 million were iPhones. That's 84% of the smartphones sold by AT&T in the quarter were iPhones. So both those carriers seeing their customers choose the iPhone as their phone of choice, at least in the last quarter, and that may likely have been influenced and impacted by the release of the iPhone 5, but still some significant numbers. Over the past couple weeks, we've been talking a lot about the rumors of next generation iOS products, and this week we saw a lot of information coming out of iLounge. They've been getting a ton of leaks over the past week, apparently, and from some very reliable sources. In the past, iLounge has been pretty reliable in terms of their rumors. So when they're reporting on something, you can kind of assume that they have a pretty good inside track. They shared a lot of details on the next generation iPad and iPhone lineups, and so I wanted to go over a couple of those with you. We had that rumor about the larger iPhone, the iPhone math, what I think is actually a mistranslation and likely some, you know, could be codenamed the iPhone Max. But that's my own term. I haven't actually read that anywhere. So that's a MacCast exclusive. But DigiTimes was saying that Apple is working on a 4.8-inch phone. They kind of backtracked on that a little bit this week. They say it's still in the works, but they now claim that it might not come out this year. I think that rumor was also put out there by the New York Times, if I'm remembering correctly. But there still is a prediction that we will see an iPhone 5S possibly this summer. with some updated specs and things like some new color choices, maybe colors in line with the updated iPod touches we saw this past year. And iLounge seems to be reiterating that summer release. They're saying July update for the iPhone 5S, and they add that it will possibly have a 13 megapixel iSight camera. Now, the other rumor we'd been hearing is that Apple's working on two model iPhones, the updated iPhone 5S and possibly a cheaper iPhone, even though Phil Schiller says that there isn't one. iLounge claims that their sources say there is and that they even know some of the specifications. They do say that it's going to be made mostly from plastic, but they say it's not going to be like the iPhone 3G or the 3GS, which is what I thought Apple would probably do, you know, sort of reuse that design and that tooling to get a cheaper iPhone out in the market. But iLounge claims that that is not what Apple's going to be doing. There was also some rumors that it would just be a plastic version of the iPhone 5 design. iLounge says that's not quite it either. They're actually saying what it's going to be is more like a cross between the iPhone 5, the fifth generation iPod Touch, and the iPod Classic, so kind of taking little bits and pieces from each one of those designs. So what exactly does that mean? Well, they're saying it's going to have a 4-inch screen like the iPhone 5, that the bottom of the iPhone is going to look more like an iPod Touch, and the overall shape of it is going to be more in line with the iPod Classic. So they say from the front, it's going to look like an iPhone 5. It's going to have a non-retina screen, but it will be a larger resolution because of the taller form factor, 1136 by 640 on that screen size. And they say that the glass will stick up along the edge, just like on the iPhone 5 and the iPod Touch. So sort of raised above that really thin form factor. And it will have elongated volume buttons, more like what we saw on the iPhone 3G and the 3GS. So it's not going to have the little round ones that are on the current iPhone 5 or the iPod Touch, but the more oval-shaped style buttons. They also say that the shape will be more like the iPod Classic, allowing for a flat back and flatter side surfaces with kind of rounded transitions between the different edges. And of course, you have the flat glass on the front. So if you've ever seen the side profile of the iPod Classic, you'll get an idea. I would assume it's going to be much, much thinner than that. But the idea here is it would be easier for Apple to get buttons and ports on those flatter edges, and they're not going to have to work to integrate those seamlessly into the design of a curved edge, say like you would have on maybe the iPad mini, which is that's tricky to do. And I would imagine from a manufacturing standpoint that could drive up costs. So having those flatter edges is going to make it, I think, a little bit easier to manufacture and to assemble, and that will help bring the cost down a little bit. iLounge says on the back we're going to see the camera, the microphone, and the rear flash. On the bottom, it's going to have a headphone port, a lightning port, a bottom microphone, and the little speaker grill. They do note that the speaker grill is going to have four little holes and look a lot like the iPod Touch. It'll be down there on the bottom right. So if you've seen those designs, or if you head to Apple's website and look at those, you'll get a feel for what that's going to look like. And I would say overall, after reading this, it makes a lot of sense. A lot of things that they're mentioning here in terms of design and form factor. And if Apple can really pull it off, this looks like it's going to be a very nice device, a good alternative, lower priced alternative to the iPhone. And that may be where Phil Schiller is splitting hairs a little bit, saying Apple's not going to do a cheaper iPhone. They're going to do a quality iPhone, but at a lower price point. And I mentioned, I think, on the last show that I think it is probably time that Apple starts expanding the line and starts competing at multiple levels. It's become a mature product. The iPhone has become a mature enough of a product that they need to do a similar thing like they did with the iPods back in the day when Apple sort of had the dominant market share for a long time. Then as their competitors started to catch up and bring out lower cost alternatives and things like that, that's when Apple started expanding the product line. They brought out things like the iPod Shuffle to help compete, but still the iPod Shuffle was not another Me Too product. And I think that's what we're going to see here. Apple's not just going to put out a Me Too lower cost phone to compete with their competitors. They're going to put out a really high quality product at a lower price. And I think sort of the stuff in the iLounge report alludes to that. Now, moving on to the iPad updates, you know, we'd been hearing a lot of rumors that there was going to potentially be a spring update of the iPad. For a lot of us, that feels and seems a little bit too soon. And so I think the good news here is, according to the iLounge report, they're saying we'll see an iPad update, but it's not going to be until the fall, likely the October timeframe. They have some specific details on the design, actually some very specific details. They say that the new 9.7-inch iPad is going to have almost no bezel on the left and right, so it's going to be like the iPad mini in that respect. And then as far as the top and bottom bezels, it's going to be just enough along the top and bottom to accommodate things like the EyeSight camera and the home button. They also note that the design is going to be significantly thinner, possibly using a new display technology. So a lot of the design seems to be borrowed from the iPad mini. It's going to have the same kinds of colors and finishes and take into account design cues like the chamfered edges. Basically what iLounge calls a stretched iPad mini in terms of the new design for the iPad. To achieve the extra thinness, they're saying that Apple is likely going to use a technology like Igzo technology, and I would assume also some sort of in-plane touch technology to make that display even thinner. And the thin, smaller design may call for a tweaked lower power version of the processor, maybe a tweak to the A6X chip to help Apple achieve a smaller form factor along with maintaining battery life. And as far as when we'll see that update, iLounge, as I was saying, expects the iPad 5 or 5th generation iPad to be released sometime in the October timeframe. And they're also saying that the update to the iPad mini, which we had heard some reports saying might happen again in the March timeframe, they're saying, according to their sources, they're hearing that that will also be an October update. And as far as details, not a lot has been given. About the only thing we're hearing as far as the iPad mini 2 goes is that it will get updated with a new Retina display. So I really like the fact that, according to the iLounge reports, it seems like we're getting back on a more normal iPhone an iPad release schedule, but that doesn't mean that Apple isn't going to update the iPad 4 before the new iPad 5 comes out. There's some evidence now that Apple may be getting set to bump the iPad storage sizes, and they could be doing that around that March timeframe. That may have been where we got this source of kind of two different rumors or two different dates for updated versions of the iPad. What we're hearing right now is that there could be 128 gigabyte models of the iPad 4. And this is coming from three different indicators that we're seeing. There were some code hints that were found in the beta versions of iOS 6, which was just released, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. There were also icons for a 128 gigabyte iPad that were found in iTunes 11. And now 9to5Mac has leaked images, or supposed leaked images, of a new SKU number at a major retailer for something called an Ultimate iPad. And though the SKU didn't specifically mention 128 gigabyte model, I think the question would be, what else would an Ultimate iPad be? You know, Ultimate in terms of storage. And then, so we have those three things, and then along with that, there's another supporting indicator that back in September, Samsung announced that they were beginning production on a new 128 gigabyte flash module. So that production should be ramped up, and Apple very likely could be getting their hands on those units. Even though Apple's been moving away more and more from Samsung in terms of supply, I think they're the only ones doing 128 gigabyte flash module, and it seems to make sense that Apple would want to put that in their next generation products. So far, no details have been really given on when exactly we'll see the new model, although Apple could be getting ready to bump it sooner than later so that they can stay ahead of the competition. There's also no word on pricing, but I would assume that Apple would charge about a $100 premium over the current pricing of the 64 gigabyte models. That seems to be their standard with each storage bump. You add $100 to the base price, and I don't see any reason why they wouldn't continue that. So as far as if Apple will do this in the spring, I'm kind of 50-50 on it. I could see them doing it. They may just hold off, though, and do the 128 gigabyte bump when they update the iPads in October. It's also believed that they will have 128 gigabyte versions of the iPhone, and that is expected to also land with the update in July. That would be the iPhone 5S, and we'd then have an additional storage level on the iPhone. But again, that's not expected until this summer. Looks like we may be getting closer to finding out where some of those new US-based iMacs are going to be manufactured. If you remember back in December, Tim Cook said in an NBC interview that Apple would start to manufacture at least some Macs in the US starting this year. Since then, there's been a lot of rumors about the who, what, the where of that statement, and now it's looking like maybe two of those questions might be getting closer to being answered. We got a report out of the Economic Times this week that Apple would be using Quanta Computer to make iMacs in the U.S. They have a plant in Fremont, California, and Economic Times is saying that is going to be the site where Apple is going to do their manufacturing. So that sort of gives us the who, Quanta Computer, and the where, but doesn't answer that third question as to which Mac Apple's actually going to be producing in the U.S. Tim Cook did talk to his employees in a recent town hall meeting that they held after the first quarter results call, and he talked a little bit about Apple moving the Mac production to America. He wanted to let employees know that despite what was released in the press, it wasn't a PR move, or at least not purely a PR move, but more a move to increase production of Apple's computers, something, as also was mentioned in that quarterly results call, Apple was struggling with. They had a hard time just making enough iMacs in the quarter, and had they had more production, all the executives seemed pretty convinced that Apple could have sold more Macs and likely had a better quarter. So Apple looking to gain manufacturing wherever they can, and I guess US is a logical choice for that because their suppliers like Quanta Computer and even Foxconn, they do have US-based facilities. So Apple can bring that manufacturing on board. And I guess with Quanta having facilities in Fremont and I think also Tennessee, it makes sense that Apple could be doing manufacturing there. And Quanta may have already been assembling some of the iMacs for Apple because there were reports early on when the 21.5-inch iMacs started shipping back in November that they were arriving with an Assembled in America label on them. And the packing slips for those units showed the origin of the iMacs as being in California. So maybe that was just a trial run. Quanta Computer was doing a little bit of the assembly for Apple to see if that was something that Apple wanted to do moving forward. And it sounds like they may be moving forward on that front, at least now, according to some rumors. And then finally in the news for this week, Apple released iOS update iOS 6.1. You can grab that on your device or through iTunes, and it significantly expands LTE support, bringing it to an additional 36 iPhone and 23 iPad carriers. They also added support for purchasing movie tickets through Fandango using Siri. Unfortunately, that update is US only for right now. Hopefully, Apple will expand that in the future. The update also allows iTunes Match subscribers to now download individual songs from iCloud, so you don't have to just do albums or playlists. I will tell you, though, when I brought this up on my iPhone, those are some huge iCloud buttons. You're definitely not going to miss them when you bring them up to the interface. I haven't checked it out on my iPad yet, but wow, those are big buttons. And speaking of buttons, the last update is that there is a new button now to reset the advertising identifier in iOS 6.1. So if you haven't seen it yet, you can grab that update. It is available now. And if you're an Apple TV owner, there also was an update to the Apple TV software. Apple released version 5.2. The probably most significant new update is that it finally brings Bluetooth keyboard support, so you can now pair up your Bluetooth keyboard with your Apple TV. That should make typing things out, especially when you're doing iTunes purchases, a little bit easier. It also adds the iTunes 11 Up Next feature and enhances support for iTunes in the cloud. You can get the update from the Apple TV settings, going to the general menu and running the update. The update was for second generation and third generation Apple TVs, but interestingly, there's also an update for an unknown Apple TV. Apple TV 3.2 is the designation, and speculation is that it likely is for a new international variation of the current generation of Apple TV, probably more likely than some new model that might be coming out. So if you haven't grabbed any of those updates, they are available now, and you can get them through iTunes or through their respective devices. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors. That's GoToMeeting by Citrix. You know, now that it's wintertime, business travel can be a pain. You know, you've got canceled flights, closed roads, plus you might have important colleagues you need to meet with who are maybe homesick. That nasty flu's been going around. But you can't let that kind of stuff slow down your business. You still need to meet. You still need to get things done. And that's where you need GoToMeeting by Citrix. It has all the benefits of meeting face-to-face, but you and your colleagues can be almost anywhere. And plus, it's fast and simple to use and is not affected by bad weather. GoToMeeting makes it really easy to get connected. You just click a link and use your webcam, and you're instantly connected to your team. You can share screens, you can share documents, you can see each other face-to-face in HD, and you can do it from anywhere on a computer, on a smartphone, on a tablet, and you can even present right from your iPad. Being a web developer, I need a tool like GoToMeeting because my clients are actually all over the world. I can connect with them face-to-face, just like we're in the same room, and it gives me the ability to share my screen, which makes it quicker for me to train them on maybe a new website feature I'm working on, or show them a layout or a design, and there's not that whole back and forth that you get with email. Plus, it's so easy to get them connected. I just send them an invite, and by clicking a link in the email, they can add the meeting to their calendar, they can get all the details, and they can connect to that meeting quickly and easily, all without having to do a bunch of complicated downloads or deal with anything kind of technical. And that's something my clients really do appreciate. So I really love GoToMeeting, and I want you to try it out free for 30 days right now by using this special offer. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and then use the promo code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T. Remember, use the promo code MACCAST, GoToMeeting.com, and a big thank you to GoToMeeting and Citrix for their support of the MACCAST. One of the things that I love about the MACCAST is that this is really a community, and I love getting email from you, I love getting questions from you, and I love it even more when I get a question from someone who is a new MACCAST listener and a new Mac owner. And that happened this week when I got an email from Sim. Sim moved over to the Mac about 4 months ago, and he had a couple questions about syncing podcasts, movies, and music from his iPhone 4S, which I guess, Sim, you got before you became a new Mac owner, because you mentioned you were syncing it with your old HP laptop. And so now you have a new MacBook Pro, congratulations, and you came across something that I think a lot of us come across when we take an existing iOS device that we've been syncing with a computer, be it a Mac or a PC, and then we attempt to try and hook it up to a new Mac, because you get this scary message that says, I'm going to erase all of the media on your device. If you say yes, I want to sync with this computer, and you've already been syncing with another computer, it gives you this message that says, I am going to erase everything and sync now with this version of iTunes, and you're going to lose all your data. And if you have a lot of data that you didn't migrate over in one way or another from that old system or that old iTunes to your new iTunes, you could wind up losing a lot of stuff that only exists on your iOS device or that old computer. And that may not be what you necessarily want to do. Now, if you accidentally do this, hopefully you have all that data still back on your old PC. But in Sim's case, you want to avoid any of this issue. So he wanted to know, how can I migrate my data that is on my iPhone 4S, the stuff that came from my HP laptop, get that over onto iTunes on my MacBook Pro? So, Sim, this is definitely something we can help you out with. I will tell you that the ideal way to handle this, if you're switching from the PC to the Mac, is to let Migration Assistant transfer all your data from your PC to your Mac on first boot. So when you first booted up your MacBook Pro, it should have asked you if you had any data to move over from an old system, and that could be a Time Machine backup, it could be another Mac that you're upgrading from, or it could be an old PC. And so when you run Migration Assistant, it walks you through the process of moving your iTunes library, your photos, all of your data over, your contacts, all that stuff. And it works really, really well. So you can do that. If you didn't do that on the first boot, you actually can run Migration Assistant later. But if you've already set up your Mac and you have a user account set up and you've been using it for a while, which it sounds like you have, it can be a little bit trickier, especially if you already migrated over a lot of your files manually. So if you brought your documents over and maybe you've set up iPhoto already and you have an iPhoto library and an iTunes library already on your new Mac, rerunning Migration Assistant could actually end up overwriting some things. So you probably don't want to run it after the fact. Luckily, even if you didn't migrate using Apple's migration tool, it's not too tricky to do a couple things manually after the fact. And specifically, it's not too tricky to move your iTunes library. You can actually move your iTunes library manually from your Mac to your PC as long as you prep a couple things first. So let me walk you through what you want to do. The first thing you're going to want to do is go back to your PC, back to your Windows machine. Hopefully it's still up and running. And you're going to go in to the library files for iTunes, and we're going to set those up and make sure they're set up and ready to be moved over to your Mac. So the library files in iTunes are mostly the same between Windows and OS X, with the exception of the file paths. Windows uses backslashes, for example, in their file path names, whereas OS X uses forward slashes between the different directories in the file paths. But as long as you've prepped the library files and let iTunes manage your music files for you, when you migrate the iTunes folder, the iTunes directory over to the Mac, iTunes can actually manage and sort of correct and fix those paths and stuff for you. So what you want to do is you want to start on Windows. You want to go into iTunes and go into the preferences. So go under Edit Preferences and then click on the Advanced tab. And then in there, you'll see a couple checkboxes. You want to make sure that you have checked on both the Keep iTunes Media Folder Organized checkbox and the Copy Files to iTunes Media Folder option when adding to library. Make sure both of those are checked. And then you're going to go under the iTunes menu, under Library, and you're going to choose Organize Library. And then in the dialog box that comes up there, you're going to want to say Consolidate Files. And then you're going to want to hit OK and let it go ahead and go through your library and organize it for you. And what it's going to do is it's going to move all of your media files into the iTunes folder. It's going to set up all the file paths. It's going to put everything kind of in a known state and group it all together so that you will have a simple process of just grabbing your iTunes folder and moving that over to your Mac. So it's actually going to move all your media files into some set locations. And it depends on which version of Windows you have, where those end up. So if you have Windows 7, it's going to go into your user folder inside the My Music folder inside a folder called iTunes. It's the same path if you're on Windows Vista. If you're using Windows XP, it's going to be in your Documents and Settings, your username, your My Documents folder, your My Music folder inside a folder called iTunes. So wherever that is, we're going to grab that whole folder, that whole directory, and that's what we're going to be moving over to the Mac. So on the Mac side, you're going to want to copy the entire iTunes folder from the PC to the Mac. And you can do it however you want. You can use an external drive. You could use a thumb drive. You can do it directly over a network connection. However you do it, you're going to want to get it over to your Mac. And you're going to copy that iTunes folder into the music folder that's inside your home folder on the Mac side. If you've already been using iTunes on the Mac, you do need to be aware that you're going to be replacing all of the data that is already there. So if you've already added music files or downloaded podcasts or something like that, unfortunately, there's no easy way to merge the two iTunes libraries together. So what you're probably going to want to do is make a backup. You're going to want to move the existing iTunes folder out of the music folder, get it out of the way, then migrate over, bring over the folder from your PC, and then you can come back later and manually add back in the files from the iTunes library that was already on your Mac. You can put those back into iTunes. The only thing you need to know about that is you are going to lose any of your playlists, your play counts, some of those other types of files, but you'll be able to actually get the music files merged back in just simply by dragging them directly back into iTunes after we've migrated over your PC files. So copy over that iTunes folder, and after you've copied that over, then you just need to go ahead and launch iTunes, and it should be able to find the media and at that point update those library paths. It will happen automatically, and you should be pretty much good to go. The one last thing that I like to do is I like to go back into the iTunes preferences, go into that advanced tab, and once again, make sure that a couple things are set. Make sure that your iTunes media folder path is pointed to the correct location. So in this case, it would be your home folder inside the music folder, then the iTunes media folder. Make sure it's pointing to that location. And then also make sure those two checkboxes we talked about earlier are checked. The Keep iTunes Media Folder Organized option and the Copy Files to iTunes Media Folder When Adding to Library option. Make sure both of those are checked. Then you can exit the preferences, go to File, Library, Organized Library. And again, when the dialog box comes up, check the Consolidate Files option and click OK. That's going to go sweeping through again and just make sure all of your music is gathered up and collected and put into your iTunes media folder and that your iTunes library files have the correct paths in them so that everything goes along smoothly. If you did have stuff that was already in your Mac's iTunes media folder, now you're going to want to grab that media folder, drag it onto iTunes, and let it migrate and bring all of that media back over and put it back into your library, sort of consolidating everything back together between what was on your Mac and what you just brought over from your PC. So that's how you can migrate your entire iTunes library from your Windows machine over to your Mac. Now, Sim, you also mentioned to me that you've been using the podcast app directly on your iOS device, and that you wanted to know, how do I get stuff that I've downloaded directly on the device to sync back over to my Mac so that it shows up in iTunes on my Mac? And your dilemma was that you couldn't turn on the syncing because of this original problem where it was warning you it was going to erase all your data. So now that you're set up, you should be able to enable your podcast syncing on your iPhone in iTunes, and that should get everything moving back over. So once you have all of this set up, you're going to go into iTunes. You're going to connect your device. You're going to click on the devices, and you're going to select your iTunes or your iPhone, 4S from the list. And then you're going to click on the podcast tab. And now you'll be able to go ahead and click on the sync podcasts option. At that point, you can adjust any of the settings you want for your podcasts in terms of how many you want to have downloaded and how you want to have them syncing and all that sort of stuff. Set up how you want it to work with your iPhone. And then you can go back into your library and look at your individual podcasts that you've subscribed to in the podcast section. And something to note there is when you're looking at an individual podcast in the main window in iTunes 11, there's going to be a little cog icon. If you click on that, you can actually tweak the individual settings for individual shows. So when you set up podcast syncing, you sort of set up the default for all your podcasts. But then if you want to tweak it for individual shows, so for example, I have some shows where I want it to download every episode, not just the last three episodes. I can tweak that on a podcast by podcast basis. So you might want to play around with that a little bit. But once you have that all set up, now when you sync your device, anything that you've subscribed to directly on the device should be synced back to your iTunes library. Now, the one caveat I'll mention to you is that I noticed for it to work, at least the first time, if I subscribe to a new podcast directly in the podcast app on my iOS device, I would actually have to have an episode downloaded on the device when I synced with iTunes before it would show back up as a podcast that I was synced to in iTunes. I hope that's making sense. You actually have to have a podcast downloaded on the iOS device, like a physical file, for it to sync back into iTunes and to let iTunes know, yes, I have a new podcast that I've subscribed to. I noticed that if I was just streaming episodes, so if I subscribe to a podcast on my device and I'm only streaming, because you can stream and not download the episode, when I would sync back to iTunes, it would not sync that podcast back into iTunes. So just be aware of that. But as long as there's an episode there, it should be syncing both ways and you should be good to go. After that first sync, once iTunes is aware that I have a new podcast that I've subscribed to, I can go ahead and go in there and I can tweak the settings and I can sync from iTunes back over to my iOS device with that podcast. So that's how you set things up. I hope that all makes sense. And if you have any further questions, feel free to email me, mattcast@gmail.com. Next up, I got an interesting time machine question from Brad. Brad wanted to know if there was a way to see exactly what time machine was backing up when it was running. So if you've ever used time machine, and actually all of you should be because, hey, you're a MacCast listener, right? If you're not using it, I don't know why you're not using it. Turn it on and you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. So if you're using Time Machine, you'll have a little Time Machine icon in your menu bar, and unless you've disabled it. But normally, you'll have a little Time Machine icon in the menu bar, and when Time Machine is running, you're going to see this little spinning arrow going around and around. And if you click on that little spinning arrow, it gives you a little bit of information about what Time Machine is up to. Stuff like preparing backup or backing up X number of megabytes of X number of megabytes, or it might say finishing backup. But beyond that, you don't get a whole lot of detail about specifically what's going on or what specific files Time Machine might actually be backing up at any given moment. And so what Brad wanted to know is there a way to get a little more detail? And Brad, unfortunately, I think there's not the kind of detail that you're going for, at least not through any mechanism that I'm aware of. I'm hoping by mentioning this that some of you in the community, if you know of a way to actually specifically see the individual files that Time Machine is backing up, kind of get a little progress of what's going on, let us know about it. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll share that with the community. But Brad, I do know that you can get a little bit more information using OS X's log files. And the easiest way to see this is to use the console. So if you go into the Applications folder, into the Utilities folder, and launch Console, you can click on the All Messages in the list on the left. And if you're not seeing that list, go into the go up to the toolbar and make sure that you click on the Show Log List option. And that'll give you a column there on the left of the console interface. And then you're going to want to click on All Messages. And then you're going to want in the search filter box to type the word Backup D. B-A-C-K-U-P-D. And what that's going to do is it's going to filter the entries in the All Messages log to be just the ones made by the backup daemon, which is what's used by Time Machine. And once you've done that, what you'll notice is you'll see things like the time that Time Machine started, how many files it's backed up, and how much data it copied over, and any old backups and their paths that it may have deleted, as well as the time that Time Machine finished. So you can kind of get a little bit of extra information on what Time Machine is up to and a little bit of the history of what Time Machine has been doing. If you'd prefer to more actively monitor that, monitor what's going on, you can have the console open all the time and you can kind of watch that stuff flowing through. But if you'd prefer to have something a little bit more passive, something that is just sort of sitting there that you can jump into, and you don't want to have the console actually running, the console application running, there's this really cool thing we've talked about on the show in the past called Geek Tool. It's a system preference pane, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what it allows you to do is it allows you to run terminal commands as well as monitor console logs right on your desktop. So you install it, you go in, you configure it, and you can set up all kinds of different monitoring that'll be displayed right on your desktop. It's almost like a live desktop sort of thing, but with text. And they have instructions on the website. They have little samples that you can get into. It is geeky. I mean, thus the name. It's called Geek Tool. So I'll let you play around with that if you'd like. But that's, as far as I know, the only way to get some additional information about your Time Machine backups. But again, it's not very specific. I think Brad's looking for something more specific. So if you know something that'll do that for us, let us know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And so the console actually is a pretty powerful thing. We've talked about it on the show in the past. You know, you can go in there and you can get a lot of diagnostic information. You can find out a lot of details about what's going on your system. It can be a little bit daunting sometimes because if you don't know what you're looking at, it can be a little bit scary. And as a matter of fact, I was looking into the solution for this tip for Brad. And when I was in the console, I was kind of clicking around and I clicked on the diagnostic and usage messages section, which I think is right under the all messages section from what I remember. And suddenly over on the right hand side, I see a ton of these messages that say Safari Noop, N-O-O-P. So Safari colon Noop. And they were like, it was just full of them. I'm like, what is Noop? And I expanded there's a little disclosure triangle, and I expanded that, and it seemed like most of them were referencing Flash and the Flash plugin. And I immediately got really worried. You know, you start to think, your head starts swimming, right, when you see these things. Your head goes, oh, maybe I've been hacked, something's going on, Safari or Flash has security holes, this must be a hack. And this is this point when I need to remember, and I'll remind you the same thing that I need to remind myself, is keep calm and Google. That's the answer when you run across this stuff. Keep calm and Google. So what I did was I did a little bit more explanation and or exploration rather, and I discovered that what it looked like was these things were triggered anytime I would access a page in Safari that would use a Safari plugin. So it didn't matter if it was Flash or Silverlight or QuickTime, if I hit a page that needed to rely on a Safari plugin, I would end up with these Safari nuke messages in this section in the console. And so I thought, well, it must not be that serious. But Google revealed some more information, and I guess noop, N-O-O-P, is actually short for no operation. And it's basically a computer instruction that takes up a small amount of space, but actually doesn't specify any kind of action. So this turned out to be really more of just a diagnostic dialogue kind of message, an information style message. And in reality, to me, it looks like maybe it was the kind of thing where somebody turned on some debugging, some WebKit kind of debugging, and maybe forgot to turn it off or something like that. But I'm just making a lot of assumptions at this point. I couldn't find a lot of details about specifically these Safari nuke messages. So once again, I'm throwing it out to the community. If you know something about these, if you have some additional insights, can you let us know about it or let me know about it? But so far, it looks to me like they're pretty normal. I've asked a couple of other people to confirm that they're seeing these messages as well, and they are. So I don't think it's anything nefarious. I think it's actually pretty benign. But just an odd reminder that the console can drive you crazy if you're not careful. And I'll say it one more time. Keep calm and Google. And then finally for this week, Mike D recently set up a new Mac, and he used the FaceTime camera to shoot his profile image. That's something when you're setting up your user account, you can use the camera to take an image and have that be the image that comes up when you log into your Mac and is used for your address book card and all that kind of fun stuff. Also your iChat avatar by default, unless you go in and change it. And Mike said that it turned out so good that he wanted to be able to use that profile image on other sites like Facebook, Twitter, etc. But he needs to know, where is that thing stored? How do I get a copy of it? Because it's not really easy to access. And Mike, it turns out that image is actually stored in a couple different places and a couple different sizes and formats. And some of those are harder to get to or find than others. And the image itself is actually stored as part of the directory service in Mac OS X, and there's actually a terminal command you can issue, DSCL, the series of commands, but if you issue the specific command, you can actually read that file back out of the directory service. But, you know, that's a terminal command. You gotta know the actual secret Mojo code to type in there, and who really wants to do that? The good news is that Apple actually has a directory service application, a GUI tool that you can use to at least see this information. You can't really get the image back out of it, but you can maybe find out some additional information to discover the paths to where things are and just see the image and stuff like that. So I wanted to start by pointing that out in case you didn't know where that was. So prior to OS X Lion, it was actually in the utilities folder, this little directory service application. And I think it was called something else. It was like directory utility. I can't specifically remember. But starting with OS X Lion, they actually moved it to be part of what's called the core services. That's where things like the screen sharing application are and some root level kind of system applications. But if you go into your main hard drive, your boot hard drive on your Mac, and then you go into the system folder. So this is the system folder at the root level of the hard drive. And then into the library folder, there should be a core services folder. And inside that, you'll find the directory utility. It's an application. You can go ahead and launch it. The only thing I'm going to tell you is when it comes up, be very careful. You really don't want to change any stuff in here unless you really know what you're doing, because you could potentially break your system. But it's okay to get in there and just look around. Just don't make any changes. And so when it comes up, what you want to do is you want to click on the directory editor tab, and then there's a little drop down in the users area. Pull down the drop down and choose users from the view or viewing drop down. And then when you do that, you should see a list of all of the accounts that are on your Mac in the directories. And find your name, that's in the left-hand pane, and go ahead and click on your user account. And then when you select that, you should see a bunch of different kinds of account attributes or values over there on the right-hand side. And one of those entries will either be picture, if you're using one of the OS X default images. Those are the ones that you can pick when you're setting up your profile. Apple has a couple of different categories of images. So I think there's like sports images and animal images and things like that. If you pick one of those, it'll say picture. And if you click on picture, you can see the path to where that original TIFF file is. They're actually all TIFF files. And if you don't see that, you might see an entry called JPEG photo, J-P-E-G photo. And if you see that, that is going to be your profile image, the one that you shot with the iSight camera. Now, unfortunately, you can't copy that image out of the directory services. If you're using one of the default pictures, I'll just let you know, those are stored actually in the root of your hard drive in the library folder. So the root library folder, not your home library folder, but the root one, in a folder called user pictures. And then you'll see the different categories within there. And you can go find all of those images that OS X uses by default. But the directory service is where your profile image and actually a bunch of other information related to your account is stored. So let's get back to the task at hand, finding a copy of that picture so that you can use it on these other sites. Well, one place that is relatively easy to access and find is your iChat picture. So when you take that picture, it's used in a couple of different locations throughout the system. So it's used in the directory services. It's also used for iChat and now messages in OS X Lion. Also in the address book or the contacts and trying to remember where else. Those are kind of the two big main ones. And so if you're using OS X Lion, because this only exists prior to Mountain Lion, you can go into your home folder, into the library folder, and there should be an images folder. And inside that, you'll find a folder called iChat Recent Pictures. And your image should be inside that. Now, if you're in Mountain Lion, you can try looking at the library folder at the root of your hard drive. And there should be a caches folder inside there. And if you look inside there, you might find a TIFF file with a name like com.apple.user. And then probably a number. It might be 501, I think is typically the number. picturecache.tiff. And that is very likely the image that you shot with that iSight camera. So again, if you're in Lion, look in your home folder, library, images, iChat, recent pictures. If you're on Mountain Lion, look at the library folder at the root of your hard drive inside the caches folder for a file called com.apple.user501picturecache.tiff. See how I told you it was these things were a little bit hard to find and in some odd places? If you want to find the one that is associated with your address book entry or your contacts entry, you're going to look in your home folder under library, application support, address book, and then there's probably an images folder inside there. The only trouble with this one is that it will show all of the contact images that you have in your contacts. So every person in your contacts that has a picture associated with their card, their image is going to be inside this images folder. And the file names are cryptic, so they don't make any sense. It's not like your name or the name on that address card. It's just going to be some random number. So it can make it a little bit tricky to find. You could, in the Finder, put it into like icon view, and you might be able to locate your image. Or if you've recently taken the photo, you might sort by date to find the one that you're looking for. But that can be a little bit tricky. So all these methods that I've sort of shared with you so far, I'm giving you because it's more informational, so you know where these paths are and where this stuff is, but it doesn't necessarily make it easy to get at those images. So what I want to give you is a couple ways where you can get at the image. The only thing about these tricks is that the ultimate image file isn't very large, but for using it for an online avatar, I don't think you need it to be all that big. So what you can actually do is you can actually go into a couple of locations, select the image, and then just copy and paste a copy of it into Preview and then save it out. And I think this is the easiest way to get at that image. So you can either do this through the user group system preferences or through the contacts application. So if you want to get the image out of your user group system preferences, go into system preferences, go into user groups, and then you may need to click the little lock and authenticate so you can access the account. But once you're in there, choose your user account, and then in the main panel, click on the profile image and choose to edit your profile picture. And then it will pop up, it'll bring up the editor dialog with your picture in it. And then at that point, you can go up to the edit menu and choose copy, or just simply hit Command C to copy the image. And then you can cancel. You don't need to edit the image. Go ahead and cancel out of it and exit system preferences. And then go ahead and launch Preview, the Preview application. So Applications Preview. And then from inside Preview, go under the File menu, and you should see an option that says New from Clipboard. And when you choose that, it will open up your image inside Preview. And then at this point, you can save your image. You can put it into whatever format you need, so JPEG or PNG. Go ahead and save it out, and then you should have a copy of your image. If you want to get the image out of the Contacts application, it works very similarly. You just launch Contacts, locate your address card, which should have your image in it. Go ahead and select your image. You don't have to go into edit. Just click on the image, and it should put a little blue highlight around it, little blue box around it. And then you can go under the File menu, choose Edit, Copy, and then again, exit Contacts, and then follow the same steps I gave you earlier inside Preview. Go into Preview, create a new image from the clipboard or a new file from the clipboard, and then go ahead and save out your image. And then you can use that avatar wherever you like. So that's where it's located, and a couple methods for getting that picture out and saved into a format that you can use in other areas. So I hope that helps you out and solves your problem. If anybody knows a better way or a method that I missed, be sure to share that with us. But with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of our show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make text expander, PDF pen, disk label, also PDF pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as text expander touch. You can get information on all their software, as well as free trials over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and be sure to use the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, get cash for your old electronics, your old iPhone, your Mac, your iPad. Find out what your iPhone or iPad is worth. Take a minute. Go to Gazelle.com and find out. Squarespace, if you want to build a great-looking website that's maintainable and you want to do it in minutes, not hours or days, you can do that with Squarespace. Try it free. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now. And when you sign up, you can get an additional 10% off when you enter the offer code MACCAST1. And ShareFile by Citrix. You know, you can take a lot of the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files using old methods like email attachments and FTP by using ShareFile. I want you to try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. I do have Macworld coming up. I'm going to be doing live show from the show floor Friday, February 1st from 2:30 to 3:30. If you happen to be in town, I'd love it if you'd come by and say hi. I'm also inviting Macworld attendees and MacCast fans to join me on the show. So if you'd like to do that, just shoot me an email. Let me know you're going to be at Macworld and you'd like to be on the air. Please keep your emails, your audio files coming. I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, you have a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail message there. If you'd like to call me on Skype, you can also leave voicemail messages on Skype. My Skype address is TheMacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/maccast or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.